Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist of Freedom of Faith. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Preston Washington. I'm your host tonight here on the Gist of Freedom. And our producer is Leslie Gist, author and historian. And tonight we're going to take up a discussion on the Emancipation Proclamation, as this is the 150th anniversary of that historic document. And joining us to discuss that will be Dr. Bradley Skelcher, who is a professor and provost at Delaware State University, HBCU, Historic Black College University. And are you there, Dr. Skelcher?
Yes, I am.
And how are you tonight?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. Quite a historic document, the Emancipation Proclamation. And I'm just wondering how many of our listeners actually have ever read the Emancipation Proclamation. Do you have it handy there, Doctor?
Yes, I do. I have both Emancipation Proclamations, the preliminary issued on September 22nd, and then the actual Emancipation Proclamation issued January 1st, 1863.
Okay. If you don't mind, would you read three or four paragraphs of that historic document?
Certainly. This is the Emancipation Proclamation issued January 1st, 1863 by the President of the United States of America, a proclamation. Whereas on the 22nd day of September in the year of our Lord, 1862, a proclamation was issued by the President of the United States containing, among other things, the following, to wit, that on the first day of January in the year of our Lord, 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall be thenceforward and forever free. And the executive government of the United States, including the military and naval authority thereof, will recognize and maintain the freedom of such persons, and will do no act or acts to repress such persons or any of them in any efforts they may make for their actual freedom.
Wow.
And
I think what's important there is laying the groundwork, which may not be understood by a lot of people, is that it was only those states that were in rebellion, those slave states that were in rebellion. And I believe there were maybe five states, Missouri, Tennessee, Kentucky, Maryland, and Delaware. Although they were slave states, they were not included in the emancipation. Is that correct?
Yes, the border states of Delaware, Maryland, West Virginia, Kentucky, in Missouri, along with the conquered state of Tennessee, parts of Louisiana, mainly New Orleans, and a few counties in Virginia were excluded from the Emancipation Proclamation.
And all of West Virginia was excluded, did you say?
Yes.
Okay. And I think that was because they were splitting from the state of Virginia to form a separate state at that particular time.
That's true.
Is that true?
Yes, it is.
Okay. You know what I find surprising as well is that the Indian Territory at that time, how were they considered?
The Indian Territory was actually a reflection of the United States at the time. The Native Americans split. Some went with the Confederacy, and some went with the North. For example, one of the famous Confederate generals of the Civil War was Stan Waite, who was a Cherokee. And fought primarily in the West for the Confederacy of Cherokee cavalry units. Fought in Arkansas and throughout the West. There was a virtual civil war on the Native American reservations and Indian Territory at the time. Some went north, some fought for the South.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of the governments of those tribes, they signed an official treaty agreement with the Confederate States, and it was only later that they started to split up. They were, I guess, halfway through the Civil War. They were kind of back and forth. They kind of split up and was having a war amongst themselves as well. During that period.
That's true. And following the Civil War, they, like the Cherokee, underwent reconstruction similar to the
Yeah, they had to go in and make treaties all over again. The Treaty of 1866 for the Cherokee particularly. Okay. Now, you said that parts of New Orleans, the city, and how many counties? There were a number of counties in Louisiana. Do we know how that came about, how it is that within some states, certain counties were exempted?
Yes, and offhand, I don't remember. There, of course, in Louisiana, there were parishes. I think there were about 10 parishes that were exempted, that had fallen under union control.
Okay. Now, excuse me. Prior to the emancipation, there was a Confiscation Act.
Yes.
And that was the first effort to free the enslaved. I think they were called contraband.
Yeah,
can you enlighten us some on that?
Yes. At the beginning of the war, when the Union forces were pushing into Virginia through the during the Peninsula campaign, several enslaved African Americans ran away into Union lines, and in particular, General Benjamin Butler was the commanding officer in the particular area where so many were running into the Union lines. He sent word to Washington on what to do. There, Washington was silent. And so Benjamin Butler, General Butler, on his own, improvised and called them contraband and confiscated them. This eventually Congress caught up with these military actions and passed the first Confiscation Act in August of 1861, essentially freeing any slave that was used in supporting the Confederacy. In 1862, Congress passed the Second Confiscation Act that essentially freed any slave owned by Confederates or anyone supporting the Confederate government. And so essentially any enslaved African American that could make his or her way into Union lines was essentially free. So you had had thousands of enslaved African Americans freeing themselves. And some have argued that Lincoln wanted to take control of emancipation, seeing that Congress was moving too quickly to emancipate all the slaves, and knowing that, in Lincoln's mind, knowing that he had to maintain those conquered areas and also the border states, he issued a more conservative Emancipation Proclamation. That's one interpretation. Another interpretation is he was quickly trained to catch up with Congress and wanted to take presidential control over emancipation. So there's a number of to this day debates over how radical the Emancipation Proclamation was, or how it lacked power, or didn't put into place a power to free all the slaves, only the ones still in the Confederate control.
So by confiscation, what we mean is that if you mentioned that if enslaved people could get to the northern lines, they were automatically free, and these soldiers, the army, were empowered to take them into custody, so to speak, into protective custody is what it amounted to. Did this go back as far as the Revolutionary War, that anyone in rebellion would lose everything, property, slaves,
yes.
Cattle, what
yes,
have you?
The English issued proclamations. The British issued proclamations freeing slaves owned by revolutionaries in rebellion against the crown. One of the famous, probably the most famous one, was Dunmore Proclamation. It was governor of Virginia who issued a proclamation freeing all slaves who could who would run away from their masters, rebel masters, and join the British. And that was followed later by another proclamation very similar to that. And by all estimates, about 20,000 African Americans fought for the British against the American revolutionaries, as compared to about 5,000 fighting for the Americans. Eventually, George Washington managed to convince Congress to allow African Americans to fight for the revolutionaries, and some even could gain their freedom at the opposition from South Carolina, primarily. Same occurred during the War of 1812 when the British sailed up the Chesapeake Bay. They issued a proclamation declaring any enslaved African American free who would run away from their slave masters, in particular in Virginia. There were approximately 500 ran away and joined the British sailing up, invading into Maryland and then Washington D.C. We think about 250 were placed into the British Royal Marines at that point.
I see.
So yes, there's a long history of using these types of proclamations to as military measures. And clearly, Lincoln was using the Emancipation Proclamation as a military measure to try to shorten the war.
Well, did Lincoln actually think that the proclamation was legal and that was the reason he was anxious to pass the 13th Amendment to kind of shore up that? Or at least maybe that's the way that Spielberg portrayed it in his movie?
I believe that part of Spielberg was fairly accurate, that they needed something more permanent, a constitutional amendment, to make the ending of slavery more permanent. And clearly, by that time, Lincoln had moved further towards the radical Republicans' position to outright abolish slavery. Now that the war was coming closely to an end, there was no longer a need to have a military-based proclamation like this that they could go directly into a constitutional amendment. There was really no military necessity at that time, so he could free the slaves in the border states as well as the states in rebellion at that point. So I think that part of Spielberg was correct, that he had moved to that position. I think where Spielberg missed an opportunity is they took a very old interpretation of the American Civil War and Lincoln, that Lincoln was going to be lenient towards the South and, you know, with malice towards none and so forth. Clearly by the spring of 1865, Lincoln had lost all patience with Confederates and had moved towards the radical position to undergo a more radical punishment of the South and a more radical Reconstruction, leading to what eventually, after his death, were the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment.
Mm-hmm. So the slaves in the border states, they weren't free until the 13th Amendment was passed?
Yes.
Is that what's freed them?
Yes.
Okay. Now, during the height of the Civil War, could you talk to us about Robert Smalls and his that stole the Confederate vessel?
Oh, yes.
I believe it was from South Carolina.
Yes, he was enslaved and captain of a small coastal ship called the Planter. And which was not unusual throughout the South and the Chesapeake Bay and along the southern coastal areas to have all black crews on the schooners and steamships and so forth and to be enslaved, having a whole enslaved crew of African Americans operating these ships. And it's been a question among many historians, why didn't Moore just keep on going like Robert Smalls did? Well, when you had family, you had all sorts of other obligations. It was easier said than done to just run away and leave your entire family enslaved. But what Robert Smalls did, he made that monumental decision to keep going and ran his ship into the Union blockade and later became a very important a political figure in South Carolina and actually commissioned into the Union forces. It's a brave, one of those extraordinary brave feats during the Civil War.
And they would have been considered contraband or part of the Confiscation Act is the reason they could be taken in.
Yeah.
And I believe he was rewarded. Was he paid for?
I don't know. My memory's not serving me well right now, but I believe the Planter was considered a prize. And I believe he continued commanding her. if my memory's serving me correctly.
And so there wasn't a reward for that ship.
Well, those were the, yeah. Those ships would have been confiscated, and under blockade would have been confiscated by the Union Navy, and put under Union flag, similar to the Virginia ironclad ship was a Union ship that the Confederates took and put under a Confederate flag.
And what about Mary Elizabeth Bowers? Understand she was a black female spy who pretended to be illiterate and was working for the Confederate president?
Yes.
Okay. What was her role? Who was she supplying information to? Any particular individual or general?
She was, as you said, a black spy in the Confederate president's house under Davis, and she worked as a servant and near Jefferson Davis and. Worked as a spy, giving information back to the Union forces. I'm not quite sure who in particular she worked for, but she managed to get information back. She was in collusion with a guy named McNiven. During this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I understand that Mr. Smalls moved into the home of his former slaveholder, and that it is currently a museum. Not sure in what city that might be in, city or state. So as a result of some of this, a church practice of watch night, which started out, I believe in 1770, maybe as early as 1733, by the Moravians, and was taken up by the Methodist Church, took on a great significance in black churches.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell us, our audience, what watch night was all about, or is all about? It's still practiced today.
Waiting for the January 1st, and to take in effect the Emancipation Proclamation.
Oh yeah, it was to take effect on the at midnight, January 1st, 1863.
Yes,
and. I think today it's also called, some churches call it Freedom Night or Freedom Watch.
Yes.
Because they weren't really sure that was going to come about. Getting back to Mary Elizabeth, I believe she was she pretended to be illiterate, but she was a college graduate of Cheney State. College? Had you heard anything on that?
Cheney, I suppose, depends on who you ask. Cheney was the oldest historically black university in the country, and primarily trained teachers. However, if you talk with spoke from Lincoln. Many claim Lincoln to be the oldest school for African Americans.
Okay, and that would be Lincoln in Ohio?
Lincoln in Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania, okay, because there's a Lincoln University in Missouri. Jefferson City.
Yes, sir.
That was started by United States colored troops, pooled their money together. The Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, was that started by colored troops?
No, it was actually started by white philanthropists who saw the need to educate African American youth, and presently it's part of the Pennsylvania. It's Lincoln University, Pennsylvania, similar to Westchester University, Pennsylvania. But it was Both were founded in the 1840s, but the debate is which was started first. But it appears that Cheney was started first, and primarily became a teacher school, a normal school, trained many teachers who went on to teach in primary and secondary schools throughout the South.
Yeah, other holidays that came about were Memorial Day, along with Emancipation Day, and that the Civil War, that the veterans of the black soldiers could be buried with dignity. They were pretty elaborate. Even I can remember in my mother's home state of Oklahoma, Decoration Day was a big, big holiday. And people would go back home to decorate the graves of all those who were buried there, but particularly any soldiers of any war.
In Chestertown, Maryland, there was a discovery of a black GAR hall. Probably, as far as we know.
Now what's that acronym stand for?
Grand Army of the Republic.
Okay, great.
And this was discovered just a few years ago. It had become pretty much derelict, and we almost lost it from demolition. And then some interested folk got to doing some research and found this was a black GAR building, and we think the only one left in the country in Chestertown, Maryland. And after considerable research, we found that every Memorial Day there were parades. The African American Civil War veterans would gather together for picnics and such, and parade down to the cemetery to decorate the graves. And so it became quite a tradition among northern veteran groups to celebrate what for many years was called Decoration Day. Now we call it Memorial Day.
Yeah. So was the GAR an integrated veterans organization?
Not that I'm aware of. There were white GARs and black GARs. There may have been some, but I'm not aware of any integrated groups.
Okay. I want to remind our listeners that they can call in, join in this conversation with questions or comments at 347-324-5552. And particularly if they have any remembrance of holidays and if their church participated in watch nights and so forth, we'd like to hear from you. Okay. So we come into after the Emancipation Proclamation and after slavery. Tell our listeners how Juneteenth got started and where it was started, and what's the significance of that?
Juneteenth was birth of, well, the 13th Amendment was passed, and not everyone was given the news about abolition, and slowly spread throughout the South, and the announcement was made in various dates.
Okay, and I think it was. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Juneteenth was short for June 19th, which was the time that the enslaved African Americans found out about abolition, 13th Amendment in Texas, which was, essentially they found out about Emancipation Proclamation about the same time, but found out about the Emancipation Proclamation on June 19th in 1865 in Texas. Of course, the 13th Amendment was passed in December of 1865.
Yeah, Texas, quite prominent. Was Galveston the last place that slaves were freed by force?
Probably, most likely, during a Union invasion in Galveston, probably about the last of the place. I'm trying to think. There were other places that the Emancipation Proclamation was slow. Even after the passage of the 13th Amendment, there were still pockets of areas where people were still enslaved and had to be prosecuted under the 13th Amendment. But in Galveston, Texas, that was when the word came that the Emancipation Proclamation had been issued after the invasion, which, until the invasion, it wouldn't have gone into effect anyway, because it was still you had to have a forced liberation of Confederate-held territories. But technically, the war was essentially over by that time. Anyway, even though there were pockets of resistance throughout the South, even after the Appomattox courthouse surrendered by Lee, which was the surrender of only the Army of Northern Virginia.
You mentioned something about prosecutions. Could you go to a little bit more detail about that?
I'll give you an example. In Delaware, after the 13th Amendment was ratified, there were prosecutions of individuals, and their names slip me right now, but there were cases brought to federal court over involuntary servitude, and meaning essentially that they were still holding human beings as slaves, even after it was illegal to do so. And for your listeners, the state of Delaware did not ratify the 13th Amendment until 1902. So there were still pockets of resistance throughout the country, not just Texas, where, like you mentioned earlier, where it was an army invasion that finally brought the word that Emancipation Proclamation was there, and they were actually had been free for 2.5 years, but it took a military invasion to actually liberate them. And then even after the 13th Amendment, there were cases of slavery. But even in the 20th century, we've had prosecutions of slavery where we have smugglers bringing illegal worker, essentially slaves, in from China to work in sweatshops. We've had ships detained and captains and crews arrested under piracy, under piracy laws, and in violation. So slavery continues to be a problem today, as most of your listeners, I'm sure, realize that,
yeah.
And still being prosecuted.
Talk to our listeners about the documentary Slavery by Another Name and the caveat that was in the emancipation that allowed for that slavery by another name.
I'm sorry?
Are you familiar with Douglas Blackman's work and a documentary that came out on the under the title of Slavery by Another Name?
Yes.
Oh, and there was a caveat in the 13th Amendment that slavery was abolished except it was for crimes unless a person had been convicted of a crime, and it could be used, involuntary servitude could be implemented as punishment for a crime.
Exactly, and I've once again looking at Delaware, there was a school of reformatory school for young girls, African American girls in Delaware, called the Edwina Cruz School, and it was for delinquent young girls who had broken some sort of law and put into this reformatory school, and in the charter it clearly stated that they could be used in servitude. It's clearly stated, and this was in the 1920s. I was pretty shocked when I saw it, but it's clearly legal under the 13th Amendment.
Under the 13th Amendment, yeah. Our listeners might be interested to know also that in the South, and probably in other areas, laws were changed to fit African Americans, that they could be taken into the criminal justice system. For example, certain gambling games, like shooting dice or shooting craps, became illegal, whereas poker playing was not. And basically because black folks, when they gambled, they shot craps more than they played poker. So that became illegal. Vagrancy laws became implemented. And if a black male could not prove that he was gainfully employed, then he would be arrested and taken to the jailhouse. My father, who was born in 1916, could remember being a young man and in the 20s and 30s, stopped by the police, and the police would ask to see your hands. They wanted, you know, palms up. And if you didn't have calluses, you were arrested for vagrancy.
Mm.
And he just recently died here, 94 years of age in 2010. So, and I understand that the Slavery by Another Name lasted up through World War II. And there were some big companies involved, Standard Oil, your steel companies in Pennsylvania were quite dependent on convict labor.
It's still fairly prevalent, the use of convict labor throughout the United States even today, in certain manufacturing and other things. And I remember a previous show about Pap Singleton moving west right after the Civil War. Many freedmen exercised their newly found freedom by just moving, just going from place to place. And people who observed this and wrote about it were just amazed at the numbers, the thousands of African Americans moving around, just exercising their freedom, and many left to seek better lives in the North and in the West, and as a result, depriving the South of labor. And the South just continued to resist modernization and mechanization in agriculture, relying upon labor-intensive production, and attempted in many ways to stop this movement, this out-migration, including arrests and penal farms and debt servitude and debt peonage and all sorts of methods to replicate the forced labor and yet to comply with the 13th Amendment. So that method of securing a labor force was prevalent right after the Civil War, and as you said, even through the World War II era and into the 1950s. And vagrancy was one way to secure labor, arrest someone and put them on a work gang. And I've heard some notorious stories. I grew up in the southern part of Illinois, and I would hear stories about people, you know, traveling through the South and looking, you know, and not having any clear sign of employment and ending up arrested and put in the work gang.
Yeah, you mentioned that some of that is still going on in the criminal justice system. I'm reminded, you're familiar with Michelle Alexander's book, Mass Incarceration in the Area, the New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration. And she asserts that there are more blacks in the criminal justice system, either incarcerated or under supervision, than were enslaved in 1850.
Yes,
and I guess my thought is, although this mass incarceration seems to be more then than now, it doesn't seem to be for labor's sake. Are these inmates still being put out there today for labor, or are they just being incarcerated?
Well, I think there's both. All sorts of sociological theories and criminal justice theories about the criminal justice system, but we still have convict labor throughout the country producing goods and services, and whether that's the primary motive these days, I doubt it, but. The others, of course, the debate is that the criminal justice system is skewed towards incarcerating African Americans, minorities. If you're in the West, Native Americans, and the poor, it's
Southwest, it would be Hispanics.
Yes.
You know, it's. I think in the state of Texas, privatization of the prison system is probably the number one industry in the state of Texas. Seems to be just another form of plantations.
I haven't seen the numbers on it, but it wouldn't surprise me if there was one important. Economic sectors of the state. I know many areas they're relying upon prison systems for employment. As I was saying, in the southern part of Illinois, there's there's many, many people are employed in the criminal justice system, prison systems, and there's a controversy going on right now about the governor closing or threatening to close one of the prisons, and people are protesting that. And
Here recently, a Pennsylvania judge was arrested because he was sending juveniles. He was getting cash back, kickbacks for sending juveniles to a juvenile detention center privately operated.
Yes.
I think if our listeners wanted to Google Kids for Cash, and there's an extensive story on that. But I'll let you go ahead and expand on what you were saying.
Well, looking at the Emancipation Proclamation and seeing the, and matter of fact, just looking at the entire Civil War and the causes of the Civil War, I mean, clearly, without slavery, there would not have been a Civil War. Clearly, the South saw Abraham Lincoln as and Republicans moving into Congress and the White House as a threat against slavery, their labor system that they had come to rely upon. They broke away from the Union in an attempt to save slavery, that system, that labor system, that system of unpaid labor. By all estimates, slave property in the South was, if you compared the other property wealth in the entire country, slave wealth property in the South had twice the value of all the other property in the country at the time. That's how much the South valued. That was the value of slavery in the South. Twice the wealth of every, you're talking about industries, manufacturing, shipping, slaves, property in the South was twice the value of all the other accumulated property in the country at the time. The South understood what that meant. The slave property meant they had borrowing power. They could leverage that property into all wealth, mansions, luxury, you name it. They knew the value of that property, and that's why they broke away to protect that property and that labor system. And we fought the worst war in American history. More Americans dying in the American Civil War than all of our wars combined, over slavery and that labor system. That's how important it was.
Speaking of the importance and of the labor system and the value of that labor, could you take our listeners back to the Gold Rush of 1849, and Henry Clay made that compromise, and which brought about the negotiation for the Fugitive Slave Law?
The compromise of 1850. We can go back to the Missouri Compromise and so in the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the Kansas the Nebraska Compromise. We can look at a number of compromises, all of which was an attempt to push the issue of slavery to the next generation. So the current generation didn't want to deal with it. So Henry Clay, the great compromiser at the time, came up with these particular bills, like the Missouri Compromise that brought Missouri into the state into the Union as a slave state and Maine as a free state, and abolished slavery north of 3620, which was violated by the Kansas Nebraska Act.
Now, you said below the 3620. What is that?
Or abolished slavery above 3630 degrees north. In other words, you could not extend slavery in the territories above that line. That was,
was that the so-called Mason-Dixon line?
No, the Mason-Dixon line was a survey that was ordered by the Penn family and the Calvert family in Maryland to settle a boundary dispute between mainly Delaware and Maryland, and eventually that line became associated with the South below the Mason-Dixon line. But 3630, that was a compromise to keep slavery from extending into the territories north of that line. So Henry Clay said that slavery could extend into the territories south of that line, but not north of the line. And in 1820, that really wasn't much of a compromise. It was skewed towards the north and not allow slavery into the territories beyond that, because it was Mexican territory at the time. But the compromise of 1850 came as a result of the Mexican War and the accumulation of vast new territories that were quickly becoming populated by free forces, people who were opposed to slavery. California was the first state to receive a massive influx of population as a result of the gold rush, and the people moving into California were against slavery, but didn't stop some Southerners from bringing their slaves into California to work the gold fields for them. But nonetheless, when California wanted to petition to come into the Union as a free state, New Mexico wanted to come in as a free state, and abolition of slavery in the District of Columbia, all of which the big compromise of the South was the Fugitive Slave Act, which empowered Southerners to retrieve any runaway slaves in the North and use the Federal Marshal Service to do so. And federal marshals were empowered to deputize any citizen to help in the process of retrieving runaway slaves. It infuriated the North. But nonetheless, that gave a considerable amount of power to the South to go into the North to retrieve slaves. At that point, no African American, essentially, in the North was safe, especially ones who had run away. Like Harriet Tubman actually left and moved into St. Catharines, Canada, because she was no longer, she didn't feel safe in New York, Auburn, New York, anymore, so she moved into St. Catharines, Canada. That's how critical that Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was, and it essentially helped accelerate the path towards disunion. It polarized the North into even it solidified the North even more in their position against slavery, and also emboldened the South to take more bold measures in retrieving slaves.
So that sounds like it actually, these compromises starting as early as 1850 and all those other little small compromises that you mentioned were the seeds that brought about the Civil War.
I think that you could legitimately argue that the compromises started with the writing of the United States Constitution.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry?
Did these compromises, part of these laws were also whites could be imprisoned if they were helping out helping blacks escape, particularly on the Underground Railroad?
Yes. There was a famous ship captain from Wilmington, Delaware, named Captain Fountain, who operated clipper schooners up and down the coast. These were like freight, like semi-trailer trucks today. They're hauling freight up and down the coast on these clippers, and Captain Fountain would take runaways in his cargo below decks, and take them up into Delaware, and then they make their way into Pennsylvania, or he'd just go directly into Pennsylvania or New Jersey, and they would dip off and just blend in with the population at that time, and you know, escape. And Captain Fountain was eventually captured in the late 1850s and sentenced to 10 years in prison. The abolitionist movement took up collections for his family to help support his wife and children. But that was serious. People did hard time. Hard labor in prison. There was a famous Reverend Green in on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. He was accused of helping runaway slaves, and they found a copy of a map of Canada and a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin, and used that as evidence to convict him. He also was convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison. So that was a serious act, and people were convicted and sentenced to prison.
And the new fugitive law was a revised law that was made in 1792, and the new law demanded due process. Bounty hunters were required to obtain a warrant. And for those that didn't, is this what caused a lot of skirmishes, particularly the so-called border skirmishes between bounty hunters and those people who were assisting the slaves, particularly along Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska area?
Well, the Leading Kansas, as it was called, was the result of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Senator Douglas from Illinois, Stephen A. Douglas from Illinois, wanted to win the presidency. He wanted to be president of the United States. So he came up with a scheme that would propel him into the limelight and the leadership of the country, and that was to take Nebraska territory and divided into two territories, Kansas and Nebraska, and let the citizens of the territory decide on whether they would be slave or free. In essence, overturned the Missouri Compromise and won Swift Sleuth. Now, Douglas thought that was a safe thing to do. The last thing in the world he thought, Kansas people would vote for slavery. Well, what happened? The so-called border ruffians from Missouri, led by Senator Atchison, crossed over into Kansas to vote for a slave constitution. The New Englanders saw what was happening. They created a New England immigrant society and moved New Englanders into Kansas to vote for a free constitution. And what ended up happening was the Bleeding Kansas, the preview to the American Civil War, and famous John Brown led many of the attacks against the slave forces in Kansas during that time, including killing of some pro-slave people who apparently didn't own slaves, but nonetheless, that's what the Kansas had become a battleground over slavery whether the Kansas would be slave or free. Basically a political maneuver by Senator Douglas so he could use that to go into the White House, and it essentially backfired on him. He called it popular sovereignty. Other areas like in Pennsylvania where slaveholders from Maryland crossed over to retrieve runaway slaves in Pennsylvania led to a battle between African-American slave owners near Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And then other attempts to free slaves like in Ohio at, I'm drawing a blank now, small college in Ohio where there was a famous rescue of a runaway slave who was captured by marshals, and the people came and Oberlin, Ohio, where Oberlin College is located. People went out and rescued a runaway slave who was captured, being held by marshals. They were arrested for the rescue and put on trial. I don't think anyone went to jail over that. And some of the Oberlin students joined John Brown actually, and joined him in Kansas. You had rescues in Boston, and at similar many of these scenes throughout the North of citizens rallying together to rescue captured runaway slaves by marshals and freeing them, putting their lives and freedom on the line to do so in violation of the 1850 Act. And some did have legal warrants to take the slaves back or the runaways back.
Okay, and that Oberlin, that was the first white school to integrate voluntarily. That you mentioned. I'd also like to make a clarification. Is the Slave Act of 1792 required a warrant, whereas the new law of 1850 did not. Now, Professor, can you tell us how that fugitive slave law of 1850, and how did the colonization society, who were trying to force free blacks and abolitionists back to Africa, and which actually started a diversion of those blacks attempting to be freed by force to go to Canada. Can you enlighten us on that a bit?
The American Colonization Society was founded in 1816 transport free African Americans to the colony of Liberia, next to Sierra Leone. It was somewhat modeled after Sierra Leone, except for the real underlying motivation was to move freedmen to Africa, who many of the whites, in particular in the South, saw the freedmen as bad for the slaves. They saw them in bad influence, so to speak, and where the slaves would see freedmen, they would, of course, want to be free. That was the thought, so let's move them to Liberia. And so you saw, if you look at Liberia today, you see a lot of American place names there, like Maryland. Even Monrovia was named after President James Monroe. You see a lot of those place names and even family names. There's still many family relationships between people in Liberia and in the United States. Even Lincoln, early on before the Emancipation Proclamation went to Delaware and proposed a emancipation by the government going in and purchasing the freedom of the slaves. There weren't that many by the American Civil War. About 3% of the African-American population was enslaved in Delaware. So Lincoln deliberately picked Delaware because of the low population of slaves to go to the slave owners and offer them this proposal to purchase the slaves, free them, and then transport them to Liberia. That was the plan. The slave owners in Delaware refused to take Lincoln up on that offer, and it failed, but compensated emancipation and colonization was Lincoln's was his plan for the border states in particular, but that plan fell through. As Lincoln would say, that plow didn't scour.
Okay.
So those were the attempts at colonization, and by and large, many freed African Americans in this country resisted it and saw what it was and considered themselves Americans and had paid the price of freedom and had contributed to building the country, and saw colonization as for what it was. Frederick Douglass opposed it. Richard Allen opposed it. Many of the African-American leaders of the time opposed colonization.
And some of those conflicts going on in Liberia, even to today, is the strife between the indigenous population versus the African-American immigrants.
Yes.
Divided that country for a number of years, and I don't know that a lot of our listeners may understand that particular history there in Liberia, but that's what it was all about: indigenous versus the immigrants. And and you mentioned I could really see this picture now, how free blacks were really wrecking havoc on the slave economy and the slaveholders relative to helping on the free blacks were helping on the Underground Railroad, boycotting slave-made products, and just publicly assisting blacks that were rescued.
In many southern states, like North Carolina, had laws that required any slave that was freed, whether you purchased your own freedom or the owner just freed you, they were required to leave the state. And so you had this interesting system of semi-freedom, where you had slaves that were technically free, but because of the law that would require them to leave the state, remain slaves, so they could stay with their families, and so it was just some odd system that had emerged because there was the fear that the freedmen would be bad influences on the slaves. So if you got your freedom, they required you to move. Of course, it would be difficult to move anywhere because virtually every state has a similar law like that.
Yeah, and this the strength of this fugitive slave law of 1850, that even caused Frederick Douglass to have to move to Canada.
Yeah, he left the country in for 2 years. He was in England for 2 years because of he was afraid for his freedom, and eventually a group of abolitionists purchased his freedom so he could return to the United States, and he was criticized by many of the more radical abolitionists who said you cannot, it's impossible to purchase freedom because it's illegal to own another human being. So how can you purchase the freedom of another human being when it's immorally and illegal? So even Douglass was criticized for accepting the offer of you know, abolitionists purchasing the freedom for him.
Mm-hmm. And explain to our listeners the impact that David Walker in his literature in reference to those blacks that were enslaved.
David Walker wrote a series of articles in the Colored America that was the first African-American newspaper. Samuel Cornish was the editor from Delaware, by the way. Daniel Walker essentially advocated the slaves to rise up against their master and smite them in biblical terms, and free yourself, resist slavery by rising up against them, which is what Nat Turner did. Rose up and was trying to escape with his followers, and in the process of escaping, killed 55 whites before he was eventually captured, put on trial, and executed, which led to many other severe draconian laws in the South against both free and enslaved African Americans. Mm-hmm. But David Walker's appeal was essentially advocating slaves rise up against your masters in the South, which was what the more radicals like John Brown, Nat Turner, and others saw that was the only way to secure freedom, and eventually that was the only way to secure freedom was violent war against it, the Civil War. So essentially, these were portents of future events.
Were there any other writers at the time on the order of Mr. Walker?
Henry Highland Garnett was a follower of David Walker. He took his inspiration from David Walker's appeal. Henry Highland Garnett was enslaved not far from Chestertown, Maryland. His father, when he was 10 years old, led his family to freedom out of Maryland, in Pennsylvania, eventually to New York. Henry Highland Garnett became an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church. Ironically, his church in New York was an all-white congregation, but he advocated his famous words, resistance, resistance, resistance to slavery, and was also an advocate of the Back to Africa movement, black nationalism and Back to Africa movement, very much in a different vein as the American Colonization Society. I mean, it's coming from a different perspective, but very, very important in the abolitionist movement at the time, Henry Highland Garnett.
Mm-hmm. So it was the influence of these free blacks that probably motivated the Colonization Society to want to move them out.
Yes.
And so do you think the Colonization Society was sponsored and funded by Southern slaveholders?
Oh, yeah.
Is there any proof of that?
Well, Henry Clay was prominent. I'm trying to think of, he may have been the president of the Colonization Society.
Oh, okay.
Henry Clay, probably the most prominent person in the society, from Kentucky, and the Great Compromiser. It was very, very clear what their intent was. It wasn't wasn't a benevolent society by any means, is a way to rid the country of whatever they saw was a potential problem in order to keep keep the slaves enslaved. And they were. And they were. They were a thorn in their side. No question about it.
Yeah, and Paul Cuffey also was the head of a Back to Africa movement. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yes, Paul Cuffey was a very, very wealthy merchant, merchant from Boston. I keep coming back to Delaware, but he was a member of the Friends Society of Friends, the Quaker Church in Wilmington, Delaware. Because he was a transatlantic merchant shipper, he had contact with people in Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone was a British colony of free African Americans who had fought on the British side during the American Revolution, who were evacuated to Nova Scotia, and eventually were part of the Sierra Leone Colonization Society or something. I don't remember the name of the company. And a Sierra Leone company. Had petitioned the Crown, and who eventually negotiated with West Africans in what's present-day Sierra Leone to create a colony of these African-Americans from the United States who fought for the British, who were evacuated and then eventually colonized in Sierra Leone. Paul Cuffey had contact with them, experience with them, saw this was a pretty, in his mind, a good idea, so he helped transport African-Americans from the United States to Sierra Leone, which became the model for the colonization society, which had completely different motivations to establish Liberia, Sierra Leone's neighboring country.
Very interesting.
And Paul Cuffey was an African-American, too, by the way.
Okay. Could you give our listeners your contact information should they want to follow up with you with more questions?
Oh, certainly. My email is B for Bradley, BSKELCHER at GESU.edu. That's BSKELCHER at GESU.edu. Be happy to answer any questions about the Emancipation Proclamation or Civil War in Underground Railroad or anything like that.
Okay. And I also might mention that you have published a book relative to the history of Delaware State College.
Yes, I have. Published two editions on African American education in Delaware from 1865 through 1940, and a chapter in a book on the post Brown era with all deliberate speed, and written some. Reports for the state of Delaware on African American education from 1730 through 1940 that established the plan to preserve schools in the state, and also African American settlement patterns in central Delaware. A report for the state of Delaware.
Yeah, and moving back to those individuals and institutions that were very involved in this getting free blacks to move them back to Africa and the threat that they posed, and we see later on with Rosewood and the Black Wall Street there in Tulsa was the evidence of the problems that were started, at least from their perspective, and why they became a threat to the economic system. And so they had to, the United States or the slaveholders and whatnot had to be rid of any self-reliant blacks in any communities that sprang up. And so that was an example of that. Do you have any closing thoughts, Professor?
Just for the listeners to think about January 1st, 2013, as the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, and despite the Lincoln's motivations at the time, despite the critics on both sides of the Emancipation Proclamation, that it didn't go far enough or it went too far and so forth, Lincoln did issue the Emancipation Proclamation. It did begin the process towards ending the Civil War. Also, another piece of legislation that was passed was the Militia Act, and the allowing African Americans to join the military, and rising to about 200,000 African American soldiers joining the Union. That was the size of the Confederate Army at the time of Gettysburg. When you think about the self-emancipation of enslaved African Americans running away from slavery that eventually forced the Congress to pass legislation, the First and Second Confiscation Act, the Emancipation Proclamation from the President, these were all a part of self-liberation by African Americans in the South, and then the joining the military effort that produced overwhelming superior force of the North that allowed them to essentially crush the rebellion. I'd just like for the listeners to think about that on January 1st, that this 150 years ago, that it started the movement that changed the United States of America forever. Even though it's been slow to change, it did start that change 150 years ago on January 1st. I'd just like for everyone to pause and think about that.
And as they're pausing to think about that, making their New Year's resolutions, we want them to keep in mind and reflect on the Middle Passage. And thank God that our ancestors came through that Middle Passage, and that we're here today as evidence of that hellish voyage that they came through. Also, I want to remind our listeners to tune in this Thursday at Block Talk Radio / Gist of Freedom, where we will continue our reading of the book by Benjamin Quarles, The Black Abolitionist. Myself and Professor Shabazz and Ty Smith will be here. We will listen to, I believe, chapter 3. Then we'll have a discussion, and appreciate our listeners calling in and giving us their perspectives on the Black Abolitionist. And it's important to understand that there was just more than Lincoln and his Emancipation Proclamation. There were more Black abolitionists other than Frederick Douglass and people of that vein, that there were hundreds and hundreds of Blacks fighting for their freedom and involved in that freedom movement. Professor Skelter, as always, you've been a great guest, very informative. Appreciate your participation, and hopefully you and I will be able to get together again in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, great. And I think I want to say good night right now. Good night, folks.
Good night.